Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This April 15th, Tax Day, finds the nation's deficit continuing to soar. Growth would help balance the books, but there are tough choices here, too. Cut entitlements, cut spending, or raise taxes. To some, higher taxes are now inevitable. But how much? How soon? In what form? And who will pay? And how will Americans respond? This hour on Point, will we have to pay up in higher taxes to bring down the deficit? Joining me first today from Berkeley, California, is Alan Auerbach. He's professor of economics and law and director of the Birch Center for Tax Policy and Public Finance at UC Berkeley. Former deputy chief of staff of the U.S. Joint Committee on Taxation. Alan Auerbach, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
And with us from Washington is Bill Frenzel. He was a Republican congressman from Minnesota's 3rd District for 20 years, was ranking Republican on the House Budget Committee, now a guest scholar in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Bill Frenzel, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you both. We've got a giant deficit. Everybody says it's growing like crazy. There are a lot of things you could do about that, but taxes seem more than ever on the table. Paul Volcker, Federal Reserve chief under Ronald Reagan, saying essentially last week, if we need them, we need them. Alan Auerbach, how do you see the situation out there? Is there a way around higher taxes for the American people?
I don't think so. We have spending growing because of very rapid entitlement spending growth, that is Social Security and Medicare especially. And those are going to continue to grow, even if we reform the programs. So there's really no way we can avoid at least some increase in taxes over the next several years to help pay for the entitlement programs that we have. We'll probably need reform on the spending side, too, especially with respect to the entitlement programs. But that won't be enough in itself.
And are you talking tweaking taxes, tiny
No.
changes in marginal rates, or something more substantial?
Well, the changes in marginal rates will depend on how we change the tax system. But if we think about how much we have to increase taxes, it probably has to be by at least a few percent of GDP. And since we traditionally raise perhaps 18 or 19% of GDP in taxes, that means that taxes will have to go up by somewhere between 10 and 20% at least.
So we're talking quite significant increases there. Bill Frenzel in Washington, do you agree? Are tax hikes now inevitable in the United States?
Well, they're not inevitable, but as Dr. Auerbach says, they look like they're going to be very hard to escape. If I were king, I would take a whack at the spending first. But in our political system, it seems likely that there will be some sort of compromise developed between people who don't want a tax and people who don't want to reduce spending. And there'll be some kind of a combination. We are talking about a gap of 3 or 4 or more percent of GDP that has to be made up. And is likely to be a fairly big bite, both out of spending and has already been suggested, most of that out of the entitlements, and a fairly big shot at taxes as well.
Bill, you know, traditionally, at least in the past few decades, Republicans would say, let's get out of this with growth and spending cuts. Is that not possible this time? Not that it ever was. I mean, deficit grew even in some of the periods where that was the reigning philosophy. But what about now?
Well, my personal preference is cutting expenditures. But in the very real world, I'm not in charge, nor are members of my party. And there is going to have to be some kind of conclusion made. We are sitting at a very high debt ratio, that is, debt held by the public to GDP, and something has to be done. And what normally gets done in this country is that there's some political compromise struck. Even if it isn't my first choice, I have to say that that's what's likely to happen.
Alan Auerbach, how do you look at that from California? Is there some combination of, you know, super economic growth and spending cuts that would solve this deficit problem without going to higher taxes?
Well, economic growth would certainly help. We've seen during the recession, for example, how much worse the deficit got because we had very slow growth, in fact, negative growth for a time.
Mm-hmm.
But that probably won't be enough. If one looks at realistic changes in the growth rate, that will have some salutary effects, but not enough. In part because programs tend to grow faster when the economy grows faster, too. For example, Social Security benefits are indexed to the growth of wages. So when wages go up faster because the economy is growing faster, Social Security benefits rise faster, too. Similar for Medicare, because those tend to be associated with the growth in wages of doctors and so forth. So we can help a little bit by having faster growth if we can figure out how to have it. But I think under any realistic scenario, we're going to still need very substantial combination of entitlement cuts and revenue increases.
What about draconian entitlement and spending cuts? Could that put us, you know, where we need to be, or it's just simply impossible, or is that a political question?
Well, I think I think it's possible in the sense of being feasible, that is technically feasible. There is a member of the Republican Party in the House on the Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, who's taken the unusual step of actually making concrete proposals, which would involve very significant entitlement cuts. I don't think his proposals are politically realistic, but at least they're useful in illustrating what would have to be done on the entitlement side to attack the problem primarily on the spending side rather than relying in part on tax cuts.
And give us a sense of that. What would that look like if you went with the Wisconsin congressman's way?
Well, for example, it would involve taking people who are under 55 out of the Medicare system, basically eliminating Medicare except for those who are in retirement or near retirement.
You mean eliminating forever? You mean when they reach retirement, they'd be on their own?
There would be an alternative system which would help people get health care in retirement, but it would be a much more Spartan system, and it would obviously cost the government less. Now, I don't think that's a realistic option, but it is a concrete proposal, and it gives us an idea of just how difficult it would be to make these changes entirely on the spending side.
Bill Frenzel, what's the hammer that's going to force the country to confront this issue one way or another, maybe by taxes here? What's the reality, what's the hammer?
I think that what forces us to confront reality is that at some point in this game, if we don't make very radical changes in either spending or taxes, or more likely both, we are going to come to a point where it costs us more money than we can afford to spend for interest costs to borrow the money. Or the market will simply tell us we're not going to be lent any more money. It would be a case of something like Greece is going through now, where we would need money to keep operating and nobody would be willing to give it. I don't think we're going to get to that point, but we're pretty close to it. Our debt ratios are high, and at the end of the Obama budget 10-year cycle, we're up over 70% of debt to GDP, and that's in the danger zone. Sometime before then, the market's going to ask for a lot higher rates or begin to squeeze us out, and I think that will be the action that will trip it.
Alan, you know how difficult the politics of this are. We're going to look at the details of what may be coming on American taxes, but how would you describe the hammer? What's going to push us there? Here's a question from a Liz on Facebook. She says, you know, it seems we can keep pushing payback time into the indefinite future. What event, she asks, might actually force us to start paying this down and dealing with it?
Well, I think Bill Frenzel has laid it out for you. We can keep borrowing until we can no longer borrow, and we'll probably be able to extend our borrowing period beyond Greece because we are the issuer of the reserve currency. We are still perceived to be a safe haven relative to a lot of the world, and so the U.S. is still a place where people like to invest and will probably continue to be so. Until we reach a much higher debt-to-GDP ratio. But we're on that trajectory. And, for example, even if one projects out, say, 15 years, we'll hit publicly held debt-to-GDP ratio well over 100%. And that would match our post-war high, where we were at the end of World War II after accumulating debt during the war.
And that's when we were not, at that time, facing all these imminent entitlement bills.
Exactly. So whereas then people could be pretty confident that a strong and growing U.S. economy was going to be able to make a big dent in that debt, which we did, 15 years from now, no one would believe that. So 15 years is beyond where we're going to be able to get in terms of our borrowing. Sometime between now and then, we're going to hit a debt-to-GDP ratio that lenders no longer consider credible for us to maintain. When that happens is hard to say, and it depends as well on what's going on in the rest of the world. We saw during the recession, for example, that with a lot of calamity in financial markets, the U.S. became a more attractive place to invest. Even though we were having quite severe financial problems ourselves, there were problems throughout the world, and when that happens, the U.S. tends to become an even more valuable safe haven. So to the extent that other countries, Japan, continental Europe, the U.K. are having similar problems meeting their debt, that may make the U.S. Have a temporary reprieve.
But it can't last forever.
And be able to put it off even longer.
Stand by there in California. Alan Auerbach, Bill Frenzel in Washington. Listeners, we're looking at taxes and the U.S. deficit, when and whether higher taxes are on the way. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Bill, let me ask you first, if I may. Here we've got Paul Volcker, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank under Ronald Reagan, saying last week, if at the end of the day we need to raise taxes, we should raise taxes. Is that a kind of tipping point right there, Bill? Is that a shift in outlook from even Paul Volcker?
Well, one argues with Paul Volcker at one's own risk. And so I don't indulge in that very often. As I told you earlier, I don't think they're inevitable, but theoretically inevitable. But mm-hmm. from a practical political standpoint, I think they are going to go up. But they're not going to go up unless they're accompanied, I believe, by important reductions in federal expenditures, notably entitlements, because I think you're going to have some kind of political compromise. I don't think taxes are going to be raised by themselves, because I don't think the political system will allow that to happen.
If they have to go up 10 or 20%, Alan Auerbach was saying earlier, how big a deal is that? Does that look minor to you, or is that a big deal? Is that an economy-changing deal?
That is something that sort of almost beyond my comprehension. As I see it, to complete a package of some spending cuts and perhaps some tax increases will be difficult enough. But if you have to raise taxes from present levels by 20%, I think it's going to be very difficult to get people to accept that. I'd have a lot of trouble swallowing that myself.
Let's go to our listeners. We've got a lot more to learn here. We want to talk about the value-added tax, but first to New Britain, Connecticut, and Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to inject a little historical perspective here. Congressman Pence asked President Obama to commit to an across-the-board tax cut the way President Kennedy did. But President Kennedy's tax cut resulted in a top marginal tax rate of 70%. 70. That's half of the current top marginal tax rate. Mm-hmm. Is it any wonder that we have twice the fiscal headache? From that kind of historical perspective, our current tax burden is really not that onerous.
We're talking now about President Obama's maybe looking at rolling back the Bush-era tax cuts that are going to expire, and that would move top rates, up to 39.6 and 36%. That's a long way from 70, you're saying, Mark.
That's a very long way from 70. And let's not forget that we've had that we've had two wars that were put on the credit card with tax decreases rather than tax increases.
Yeah, they sure were. Let us pick that up. Alan Auerbach, what about that? Americans can look back at history and find top marginal rates much higher than they are now. What do we learn from that? What do you take from that?
I think we learned that beyond some level, marginal tax rates increases are counterproductive. Before the Kennedy tax, Johnson tax cuts, we had marginal tax rates that exceeded 90% for, admittedly, on a very small part of the population. And I think the consensus among economists has moved pretty far away from that being a good idea, simply because at marginal rates like that, you're really not going to collect anything in additional revenue. Where the ideal top marginal rate should be, balancing revenue needs and incentives, is hard to say. But we're already on the path, as you said, toward higher marginal tax rates for high-income people. Not only the expiration of the Bush tax cuts for high-income individuals, but the increase in taxes that was included in the health care legislation just passed, 3.8% tax on other than payroll income for high-income individuals. So we're sure to see increases in top marginal tax rates for high-income individuals. It's just a question of how much.
And are you talking in the 30s, in the high 30s, up into the 40s? Where do you see them going?
Well, with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the the Medicare tax on capital income added by the health care bill, we're already up above 40%. It's also worth pointing out that state income taxes have been rising over time, and so the state many states have top marginal tax rates. In California, for example, it's over 10%, and you get there pretty quickly. So if you combine state and federal top marginal rates, they're already getting up there over 50%. For individuals in many states.
We'll talk about the economic impact of that, but the thing that everybody's talking about beyond income taxes is the value-added tax, or VAT, V period, A period, T period. You see it all over the place these days. Can you describe for that, Alan Auerbach, for us what that is?
A value-added tax is a tax that's commonly used around the world. In fact, the U.S. is pretty much the only major country that doesn't have some form of it. It's a like a retail sales tax, but it's imposed in a way that makes it easier to collect and enforce. And it can raise quite a substantial amount of revenue. In Europe, the value-added taxes are typically, the rates are in the teens. It's a consumption tax. So a couple of the reasons why it appeals to many individuals. First, it's a tax that's been tried, and so we know it's not simply theoretically possible. We know it can be implemented. Second, it's a relatively simple tax to administer compared to some other taxes. Relatively few taxpayers. It's not a tax that households have to worry about. They have to indirectly pay it, but they don't have to file tax returns for it. And also, it's a consumption tax. And we have a very, very low saving rate in the U.S. That's one of the reasons why we have to borrow so much from abroad. And the view is that movement in the direction of consumption taxes would help us save, encourage us to save more.
Bill Frenzel, what do you make of all the conversation around a VAT, a value-added tax now? And as a kind of fiscal conservative, do you favor it? If there have to be higher taxes, would you look to a VAT as the way?
Personally, would not, but the VAT has a lot of advantages. Dr. Auerbach has outlined some of them, and there are more. The most interesting thing to me is that the compliance costs and administrative costs seem to be substantially less than an income tax system. The bugaboo here is that people are very much afraid that if you overlay a VAT on our normal personal income tax, you're just multiplying the tax. And no tax is painless. You're still taking money away from people and giving it to the government. I think there is a substantial fear that this added value-added tax or something like it simply is another system. It will be ratcheted up with the, against the personal income tax, and probably cause a even larger growth of government when the growth of government is under at least some duress at the moment.
Can you explain, if there was a VAT of 15% to 20%, as a consumer, would that mean everything I buy would cost 15% to 20% more or less?
It would. Theoretically, it could apply to all goods and services purchased by both individuals, the companies, and governments, and foundations, and everybody. However, there are a lot of ways to draw a value-added tax. You can have exemptions, you can have credits, you can have exclusions. You can, I suppose,
on groceries or essentials, some Europeans
you,
do.
You could do that. You can also coordinate it with an income tax, make it work together, or you could use it to replace a tax like the employment tax, the Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes. You can handle it in a lot of different ways. So when you talk about the value-added tax, it's not a bad idea to be specific about what it is. The concept can be bent in a lot of different ways. In general, I think people are nervous about it mostly because it's a new tax, and it seems to be an extra one. If it were to replace some existing tax or to be walled off in some way that that it wouldn't look like simply another addition or that couldn't continue to be escalated, I think people would feel a little more comfortable with it.
Alan Auerbach, the VAT, VAT, value-added tax, is a regressive tax because it's on spending, and lower-income people have to spend more of their income to get along. I'm looking here, Bob McIntyre at Citizens for Tax Justice says it crushes the low-income and the elderly. What about that argument, Alan?
Well, that's right. A value-added tax on its own is certainly more regressive than the income tax. I think you just have to look at the entire fiscal system. We have plenty of things in our tax and transfer system that moderate regressive components. We have things like the Earned Income Tax Credit and other low-income programs. We have Medicaid. Frankly, though, we can't rely exclusively on people with incomes over $250,000 to help come up with the what we need to close the big budget gap we have. It's a laudable goal that President Obama has to rely exclusively on high-income people to do this, but eventually that well is going to run dry, and we're going to have to look at a broader population.
Let's go to Eric in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes,
I just had 2 points. One, here in Iowa, we have a constitutional requirement for a balanced budget. So every year, the state legislature fights its way through, but Iowa is not in under a massive debt load like other states like California.
Yep.
And maybe that would help get out from under some of this on the federal level. And also, I think it's estimated that 43% of Americans don't pay any federal income tax at all. So why should that other 47%, whatever.
Yeah.
Why should the rest of us pay for the rest of the country? Even if they can just pay 5%. Of their income.
Eric, we've got it, and let us pick it up. I've seen the numbers. I think it's something approaching half of Americans all in end up not paying any federal income taxes, though there's Social Security and all that. On the other hand, the top 10% of earners, that's households making above $366,400 in 2006, paid about 73% of income taxes collected by the federal government. We'll look at that. Bill, what about the relative weight of taxes? Alan says President Obama or somebody's going to have to go below $250,000 and tap some tax revenue out of lower-earning Americans to meet the balance challenge. You hear our caller from Iowa says, let's get that going. And what about a constitutional requirement of a balanced budget? I don't know if any country comes close to that.
Yeah, well, I think let's do the Constitution first. If we had a constitutionally required balanced budget, we still have to either raise taxes or cut spending to get there. It might help you stay there if you ever get to some kind of rough balance. But the federal government is not exactly like the state of Iowa, and it has duties to protect its citizens. We occasionally go to war, much as we regret it. We have recessions. Government, in those cases, is certainly going to want to spend more than it takes in. And the problem is, of course, when it's in good times, it never puts anything away. But constitutional amendment may at some time be necessary, but it won't prevent all these other travails that we're talking about. Because we still have to either raise taxes or cut spending or both. With respect to that next question about only about half of Americans pay income taxes, of Americans who earn income pay income taxes, that's correct. And in my judgment, it's a bit out of whack. I think the country was over-enthusiastic in 1986. When we chopped huge numbers of people off the tax rolls in the Tax Reform Act of 86. On the other hand, when you get down to those low levels of income, there may be a lot of people, but there isn't a lot of money, and so you have to be careful. I just personally think it's a good idea for most people to have a little bit of a stake in the government, but when you get down to a very low level of income, it is perhaps not worth pursuing taxing some of those people. 47% of the people being out of the system is too many, but I don't think we want to get everybody.
Of course, the distribution of income has changed, too. Let's get a call. Sheila, Newton, Massachusetts. Sheila, it's short before the break. What do you say?
Hi, Tom. The distribution of income is actually just what I wanted to talk about. You know, there's a large proportion of people, as you say, who don't pay any income tax, but I believe that's historically because the progressive structure of the income tax in this country has made it such that the wealth has moved to the top. And, you know, the big proportion of wealth in this country is concentrated among a tiny amount of people. And actually, if those people were taxed even to moderately higher levels that such as they were historically, that there would be a lot more money to run the government.
Sheila, it's short before the break. Alan Auerbach, are the taxes concentrated, tax receipts concentrated because the wealth is concentrated?
Yeah, we've had an enormous shift. Very steady over the last few decades in the distribution of income, and we're back where we were many decades ago, and it's been a vexing development that doesn't have a lot to do with our federal tax policy, probably, or for that matter, any other policy. It's really more the evolution of the U.S. and the world economy. But as a result, we have much more income concentrated at the top, and that has actually helped individual tax collections. We had in the late 90s, during the dot-com boom, for example, we had federal income tax receipts were just absolutely booming at the end of the Clinton administration, precisely because we had so much income at the top.
A lot of comments at the website here. Richard says, I'd be glad to pay higher taxes if I got something like Medicare for All back from it. He says, I refuse to pay higher taxes for the Bush tax cuts, for bailing out Wall Street and the auto industry, and to give Congress people and senators free health care. On the value-added tax, the VAT, John writes, if taxes need to go up, fine, but I don't want a VAT. Taxing consumption is regressive. Close the corporate loopholes and go after offshore fraud first, he writes. And Alex says, I'd rather they tax consumption than incomes. That's the VAT. It discourages waste. Let's get a call from Ned in Charlottesville, Virginia. Ned, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. My concern here is that we're going to scare the heck out of the citizens and the taxpayers of this country. They have no way of understanding the complexities of this issue. And we have a kind of a remarkable political proclivity in this country for using scare tactics to get the votes that we want. So I would just like to put forth a couple of facts that the kind of thing I would hope journalisms and our elected representatives would start using.
Let's hear it, Ned, in brief. What have you got?
Okay. For $1 trillion in current debt occurred this year, that is $6,800 per wage earner, 142 million wage earners. It can be retired over 30 years by paying $39 a month at 5% interest. Admittedly, there will be some deficit in the middle of that, so if you want to pay it off faster, you move the payment per month up to $100 a month, and you pay it off in 7 years.
And point two, that's Ned, point two?
Point two?
You had a second point?
No, that's the only point I want to make, is that's an example of the kind of information that needs to be conveyed to the taxpayers. Yes, we have an emerging problem. It is not a disastrous or serious problem. In 15 years, it could become serious.
Ned, let us pick it up right there. Alan Auerbach, what do you say to Ned? You said, you know, let's settle down, simmer down, let's not talk scary disaster. You know, a few bucks a month from every household, and we can pay it off. It's not that big a problem.
Well, to paraphrase Everett Dirksen, a trillion here and a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. The problem is not $1 trillion of national debt. Our current national debt is already several trillion dollars. The problem is where we are going, not really so much where we are right now. We currently have a debt-to-GDP ratio publicly held of between 50 and 60%. That's not great, but it's not...
Not as bad as some other countries, but then
right.
Some other countries are in big trouble. Look at Greece.
But if you look at any realistic trajectory of U.S. taxes and spending, even assuming that we grow smartly out of the current the recent recession, the debt is going to start accumulating very rapidly. And it's not going to be $1 trillion. It's going to be trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, and it's just going to keep accumulating. And so we're not talking about making the interest payments on another $1 trillion of debt. We're talking about debt that's going to be accumulating faster than we can hope to pay it off.
Let's go to David. Bill,
like
yes, please. Yes, Bill.
Get in on that, too. I disagree very strongly with the caller. We're in a very, very difficult position. We are not crying wolf. If we don't do anything, we fiddle and Rome burns. We have this high and increasing debt. The interest rates are certain to go up. That's going to squeeze out the government functions that today we think are useful, and we're not going to be able to do them tomorrow because we're going to have to pay interest with that money. We're going to squeeze money out of the private sector as well. We're in a very difficult situation here, and we have to start taking some action now. Maybe those actions don't have to be effective today, but we need to tell the world what we're going to do to eliminate our debt, or we're just going to go farther down the trail, and it's going to be much more punishing when we have to make the solution. And then we'll really have to cut, and we'll really have to raise taxes. Now we can do it with a couple of percent. In a couple of years, we will not be able to get off that easily.
Let's go to Springfield, Massachusetts. And David, David, you're on the air.
Thank you for accepting this phone call.
Yeah.
I would like to say that one of the most important things we could do to forestall these tax cuts is to have massive cuts in the military budget. I think it's obvious by now we should have never invaded Iraq. We should not have troops in Afghanistan. There aren't many in Pakistan, but they should be removed. If we did that, we're saving hundreds of billions of dollars right off the bat. And that could be applied toward retiring the national debt. Another area of great waste is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And if you recall, in 1949 in April, this is the anniversary year, the late great senator from Ohio, Robert Taft, and Glenn Taylor of Idaho, who ran for vice president, I think, with Henry Wallace, they both voted against NATO. And there were others who voted against them. I just don't remember all the names.
David, let us stick with defense for a moment here, because that is a very big number, no question, in the national budget. Alan Auerbach, how about it? There's a couple of wars David wishes would go away. Many people wish had never started, but they did, and they're on. And what about the Defense Department in general? Could the U.S. Meaningfully cut back on its deficit by meaningfully cutting back on that spending, or would taxes still be in the cards?
Well, there's no doubt that we should be looking everywhere in the budget to cut, and that we could hope to find a lot of that in defense, which is running at about 4% of GDP right now. But if you look at the size of the defense budget and the size of the gaps we're talking about, even if you entirely eliminated the defense budget, you'd still be short of what you need. So we can hope to get some of it there, but taking even a big chunk out of the defense budget is not going to solve the problem on its own.
It would help. Rob, Bill, yes, please.
Absolutely. The defense budget is 4% of GDP. Our deficit is 11% of GDP this year alone.
So it's a lot bigger than the defense budget.
Well, exactly. We could lay off the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, and Coast Guard, and it still wouldn't help us. Now, I think the caller and Dr. Auerbach are both dead right in that when we are looking at what expenses can be reduced, we cannot exempt the military. We have to make some cuts there, too. Also, when in the old days when we went to war, we used to pay taxes to finance
to cover it,
wars.
Yeah.
We've indulged in our last couple of escapades without doing that, and probably that was unwise.
Let's go to Niskayuna, New York, and Robin. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say that most countries that have a value-added tax don't also have an income tax, but they do have very strong social welfare programs. We're talking about in this country having both, and who it's going to hit are the working poor and the poor, and the people making these decisions are very, very wealthy. Most members of Congress are very wealthy people. This is very, very frightening.
You're looking, Robin, I assume, at Europe, and where many countries, most have the value-added tax, and they're kind of social safety nets there.
Yes, they have very strong social safety nets. In this country, our social safety net has been so eroded. There are so many pockets in this country. I would say right in suburbia, there's a lot of people who appear to be doing well, but they are not.
Robin, our time is short. Let us pick it up. Alan Auerbach, what about it? Could we end up with the worst of both worlds, you know, an income tax and a VAT and still not the kind of social protections that other countries with value-added tax have?
Well, first of all, let me just correct something, an error that the caller made.
Okay.
Most countries that have value-added taxes do have income taxes. If we think of the continental European countries with generous social safety nets, they certainly do have income taxes and depend quite heavily on them for revenue. It is true, though, that they also have stronger social safety nets. These countries are in trouble. They all are facing problems, maybe not as imminent as the problems in Greece, but of the same character.
Name a few. You're talking France and
France, Germany, Italy. These countries are all in the process of scaling back their social safety nets because they cannot sustain them. They have much more serious aging problems than we do. Perhaps the only thing they have going for us, going for them, relative to the United States, is that their health care costs are much lower as a share of GDP. So even though they provide more generous benefits than we do, their health care costs are not as high. But they're going to be struggling just as we are, and we should not look to Europe as a solution for our problems.
Let me ask you on another front here about what happens to economic growth, which we said at the top, it can help get you out of a tight spot as well here, and often has in the past, though this may be too big for growth alone, but it's important. I'm looking here at, this is a 2007 paper, and this is from Christina and David Romer. And of course, Christina Romer is now chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. And they write, tax changes have very large effects. An exogenous tax increase, I don't know if I can say that on the air, but of 1% of GDP lowers real GDP by 2 to 3%. They write, investment falls sharply in response to these tax increases. What about that, Alan Auerbach? Are we going to have to raise taxes, but then we're going to take a hit on growth that sort of doubles back around to bite us?
Well, the rumors are my colleagues at Berkeley, and I know that paper very well, and it's received a lot of attention. I think there are some disputes about the size of their estimates, but I don't think there's any dispute about the direction. The tax increases, particularly increases in marginal tax rates, are going to have negative effects on the economy. The problem we have, we're facing a trade-off here. We have programs that we want to keep. And the only way to keep them, even in a scaled-back form, is to have tax increases, which are going to hurt growth, or be very regressive. So none of the choices are attractive. And the problem is we have to make choices. And we maintaining the current system of having taxes too low and spending too high is not really a feasible alternative.
Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Dennis. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to see a progressive tax deduction system, and that means that what I mean by that is our system is unfair right now, and that unfairness is what's causing the problem. You and I are paying the difference for expenses that businesses write off, even if those expenses have nothing to do with the national interest or even growing the economy at all. If Walmart sells a large screen TV in their showroom and you don't buy it, well, you're now on the hook for the diesel fuel that shipped it over from China and the production of that TV.
So you want to, bottom line, you want to raise taxes on American businesses, Dennis, as a way out of this?
But not necessarily raise taxes. It might be for some large businesses. I want a progressive deduction also. So progressive income tax and a progressive tax deduction system also.
I'm trying to get my head around that. Bill Frenzel, what do you hear?
Well, I think we've probably got the most progressive income tax, personal income tax system in the world, and at least our marginal rates for corporate income tax are about as high as anybody, except maybe two or three of our competitors. So we're pretty much up there. We've already cited that a few percent, 10% of our taxpayers pay 75% of the personal income tax. That's huge. What modifies our system is that we have a payroll tax, which is hugely regressive. And when you put the two together, it comes out a little closer. I think everybody believes we should have some sort of progressive tax system. But if you take it all off the top, you are going to get a reduction in growth, a slowing of the economy, and I don't think we want to do that. I think our income tax system is certainly progressive enough, particularly after the two Obama tax increases, one repealing the Bush tax cuts for those over $250,000, and the other increasing the HI insurance costs for people in the same categories.
Alan Auerbach,
high, but we need to be careful about going higher.
Yeah, Alan, is that right that our personal income tax is the most progressive in the world? We think of Europeans as paying higher marginal rates.
I honestly can't tell you about the where we rank among with respect to progressivity. In part, it's hard to judge because we raise different amounts of revenue from the income tax. And also, you want to think about the overall system, not just the income tax. But let me just say one thing about the caller's point about modifying deductions. I think there is something here. In particular, when tax reform proposals are put together, one thing that's, including one that Bill Frenzel was involved in just 5 years ago, it's often proposed, and I think it makes a lot of sense, to scale back the value of deductions. For example, one that's always mentioned is the home mortgage interest deduction. We lose a lot of money because we give essentially unlimited mortgage interest deductions to homeowners. Now, you don't necessarily want to go after the homeowners' benefits this year, given the problems mm-hmm. we are having in housing. But over the long term, that benefit, as well as the exclusion for employer-provided health insurance, which we only took a little bit of a small bite out of in the recent health care legislation, these are things that cost us a lot of money. And if we're going to raise more money through the income tax, I think it makes more sense to do it through scaling back deductions than it does through increasing marginal tax rates.
Alan, you know, President Obama has this bipartisan commission out there with Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, former senator, at its head. They're going to come out with recommendations later this year. Do you see them coming out with a recommendation of higher taxes?
I don't see them agreeing on anything of great substance, unfortunately. There's a quite heterogeneous membership of this commission, and I think it'll be very, very hard for them to agree on anything. And their road has been made harder by the fact that some of the things that they might have proposed have now been used to pay for health care expansion. For example, cuts in Medicare provider reimbursements, increases in marginal tax rates on higher income people. These are things that they might have proposed that are essentially
out of time
available.
Right there. Some rumble to come. Alan Auerbach in California, Bill Frenzel in Washington. Thanks so much for being here. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.